Good evening and welcome to tonight's event, hosted by the Australian Fabians and supported by the lovely people at Smith's Alternative Bookshop. As some of you know, we're discussing Australia and the Asian Century Policy. I have with me two very distinguished guests. I have Professor Hugh White from ANU, who's the Professor of Strategic Studies and recently published a book called The China Choice, which examines the Asia-Pacific geopolitical, diplomatic, defense entanglement from the American perspective, i.e. what the heck does America need to think about its choices and its situation in the coming decades? And of course, we have the Honourable Kelvin Thompson MP, who is Parliamentary Secretary of Trade. He has been federal member of the seat of Wills since 1996, I believe, and before that was a Victorian state MP. He is, of course, in addition to his parliamentary roles, has long been a campaigner on issues to do with population, climate change, and environmental sustainability and Australia's future in these areas. So what we're going to do is we're going to attempt a discussion. There'll be some questions which I'll be asking both panelists. Hopefully they will come up with different answers. I assure you they have not had the opportunity to confer beforehand, and they will be graded at the end. No. Of course, there will also be a time for questions from the floor. So if you would like to think of some, please start doing so now. So I'll start basically with Professor White. Obviously, in your recent book, which I'm showing again to everyone...
I haven't paid him for this, you know.
You're looking at the issue...
I wish I'd written a book.
Can we use hand sign? We look at the kind of American situation in terms of what it needs to do in its engagement with China. They are potentially competing for, I guess, status in the Asian Pacific region. Although you hint at the impact for this in Australia, I just wondered if you would mind teasing out more what you think the kind of, what your key argument is in terms of Australia, because you've talked about America's perspective.
Yes.
So what do you think really Australia needs to do in the next 10 to 15 years?
No, well, thanks very much and thanks for the opportunity. Thanks for Kelvin and thanks for you all for coming along. Look, my sort of starting point, the reason I wrote the book is because I do think that the way in which Asia changes as China grows is the biggest shift in Australia's international setting, perhaps in our entire history. Certainly poses for us an immense challenge for how we position ourselves in an Asia which I think is going to work very differently. And I guess maybe the best way to frame that is around this question as to whether or not Australia has to make a choice between the US and China. Because very clearly, if you look back at Australia's past few decades and look at the way we see our future, we don't want to make that choice. We want to preserve a very close relationship with the United States for all of the reasons which are very deeply embedded in Australian sort of policy and politics going back decades and on both sides of politics. And, of course, we've got a very strong commitment to an economic relationship with China. You could say that our whole model of our future is that we want to preserve a very strong alliance with the United States and preserve a very strong economic connection with China. And if we have to make a choice between those, either way, if we have to make that choice, our whole vision of our future is stymied. So I think everyone would agree, certainly I would agree, that we don't want to make that choice. The question is whether we face a risk of being forced to make that choice over the next few years or decades or even sooner. And whether or not we're forced to make that choice and therefore forced down a path which is going to very much damage our vision of our future is going to depend not on us but on the US and China themselves. We won't choose whether we have to choose, they will choose, and if either of them say we have to choose, we have to choose. It's almost as simple as that. And that depends very much on the trajectory of their own relationship and in particular on how stark the rivalry between them becomes. And this is a complex question. I would say that there are many positive elements in the US-China relationship. There's immense economic interdependence and all of that. But there is also very clear elements of rivalry. And I would say those elements of rivalry are strong already, have grown a lot over the last few years, and are continuing to grow right now, and there's a real risk for Australia that the rivalry between the US and China will escalate to the point where our choices become starker and starker, and to the point where we end up having to make, so to speak, the big choice. That could happen slowly. It could happen very fast. If there's a crisis over something like the Senkakus, that could just happen, you know, almost any time. Now, it's not that that's inevitable. The trends, as I say, are bad, but there are very positive elements in the relationship as well. Both want peace in Asia. The trouble is their model for what that peace would look like is very different. To put it very bluntly, China has a model for a peaceful Asia in which it plays a leading role, and America has a model for a peaceful Asia in which it plays a leading role. So they both want peace, but their model of what that looks like and how they play into it and how the other plays into it are diametrically opposed. Now, if we want to avoid being forced into a position where we have to make a choice, then we have to think of what best we can do to encourage a reconciliation of those two conflicting views of their respective roles in Asia. And I do think such a reconciliation is possible, but it will require a very radical rethink by both countries of the kind of role they're going to play. They're going to have to find a way to share power with one another, and I would also say a way to accommodate the other great powers in the system, in particular Japan and India. That means they're going to have to treat one another as equals, and I mean by that, so to speak, equals with a capital E. That's a very demanding thing. It's very demanding for China to step back from its aspirations as it becomes the biggest economy in the world, to be the leading power in Asia as it's always been in the past in its history. It's very demanding for America to accept that it's no longer going to be the dominant power in Asia, that's going to have to accept a position of equality with a country like China, with which it has in so many ways so little in common. America's never had that kind of relationship with another great power before, and neither has China. So this is very new. And therefore very hard. It goes to very deep sense of their identity. So they can make these compromises. They could in theory, but to do it is going to require great political courage and all the rest of it from both of them, and a very clear idea of how bad it would be if they don't. Because if they don't, if we do see escalating rivalry, then the chances of a conflict between them is quite high, the chance of that conflict turning into a major war is quite high, the chance of it turning into a nuclear exchange is quite high. So the stakes are very large. So to avoid this, and to avoid ourselves having been forced to make a choice, we have to ask ourselves how we can help the US and China move towards that kind of reconciliation of their conflicting views, that kind of power-sharing deal. We call ourselves a middle power diplomatically. We quite often function as a middle power diplomatically. But I don't think we've yet taken on this challenge seriously. We do say that we want peace in Asia, but saying we want it, sort of like the Miss World school of diplomacy, you know, we all want to work for world peace. Yeah, sure, what are we going to do about it, though? And I don't think Australia has yet articulated a clear diplomatic strategy to promote the kind of reconciliation between the US and China, which will be essential if we're going to avoid having to make a choice. That, I think, is the biggest diplomatic challenge Australia faces today. It may be the biggest diplomatic challenge we've ever faced. But I think we do have resources of activist middle power diplomacy, as Kevin Rudd called it. And in particular, we've got scope to work with others on this, because what we want out of this is, I think, the same as everybody else in Asia wants. None of us want to live under China's shadow. So we all want the US to stay engaged. But none of us want to live with escalating rivalry between the US and China, because we don't want to make that choice. So we all want the US to stay engaged on terms that the Chinese in the end are prepared to accept, and vice versa. And I think the real, you know, my real answer to your question is that's what we're not yet doing enough of. That's what we need to do. And of course the second thing we need to do, because the chances, we can't assume that will work. In the end, I think it's a long shot. I think in the end, escalating rivalry is very likely. We have to start thinking about how do we prepare to protect Australia's position if rivalry between them does grow and we do find ourselves forced to make that kind of choice that we so badly want to avoid. Thank you.
Thank you. Parliamentary Secretary, should I call you Parliamentary Secretary or Kelvin?
Kelvin.
Obviously, in terms of looking at this choice and looking at our relationship with US, China and the broader Asia-Pacific region, we're now in a world in which, obviously, we become more mutually engaged with each other through trade and through economics. You know, it often comes down to it's not worth us fighting because we make so much money out of each other, to put it bluntly. I was wondering, would you mind saying a few words about our trade performance in the region? How that acts? Do you think that acts as a kind of a glue? Is that where our links are?
Look, I certainly think it does, James, and I think that trade and investment between countries does help resolve tensions and prevent tensions from arising in the first place. And the way in which Asian countries are lifting their living standards and growing their economies is one of the most striking features of our time and is set to continue. So by 2025, China will be the biggest economy in the world, India will be number three, Japan will be number four, Indonesia will be number 10. And this brings with it big opportunities for us. So in the past, Australia talked about the tyranny of distance, being far away from markets, whereas these key markets are increasingly convenient for us and bring with them real opportunities for us. And that's why the Australian government brought down the Australia in the Asian Century White Paper with a view to saying we need to orient our trade towards Asia and capitalise on this. In terms of how we're going, in 2012, our two-way trade with each Asia reached $340 billion, China up 3.5% to $125 billion, and the 10 ASEAN economies up 3.8% to $91.6 billion. So we've got a pattern of increasing exports, increasing economic integration with Asia. We've now got over 70% of our goods and services exports going to Asia. So all of those things, I think, represent a positive in terms of Australia's well-being, in terms of the well-being of the countries in the region, and in terms of enjoying good relations with each of those countries.
Thank you. Now, obviously, since you wrote the book, there's been a number of kind of trade and diplomatic developments. We've seen that the PM took a significant ministerial delegation to China this year and won some quite significant, I don't want to say concessions, but did a lot of good in terms of solidifying great relationship with China.
Yeah.
Do you think that you've talked about the middle power kind of a capacity of Australia, and in your book you suggest that, you know, that there isn't a role necessarily for Australia as a honest broker between US and China in a way that some people might think looking at what we're doing. You know, because we've got Marines in Darwin, yet at the same time we've been able to expand very close ties to China.
Yeah.
Did the recent successes in China make you rethink some of that? Or
No, I do think they're quite significant, but I think we need to look a bit beyond some of that. I mean, I think, you know, the starting point and the point Kelvin's made is very important. That is that, you know, the best news about Asia is the astonishing economic performance, and that's proved to be extraordinarily beneficial to Australia, and it's to great credit to Australia and successive governments that we've made so much a benefit out of that. And there's no doubt that intense economic interdependence does give everybody a great stake in keeping the system working. Unfortunately, it doesn't guarantee that it will keep working. It provides incentives for countries to make the adjustments necessary. It doesn't absolutely guarantee that they will, and sometimes it can even have a kind of a counterproductive effect. I spent a lot of time talking to both Americans and Chinese about this, and there's a very common pattern of conversation I have whereby the Chinese say to me, "Oh, Hugh, you're way too gloomy about the trajectory of our relationship with the United States, because, you know, the Americans in the end understand that they can't afford to disrupt their relationship with us, so in the end they're going to have to make way for us." And you go to Washington and they say, it's much more like this, "Hugh, mate, you're way too gloomy about the relationship with China," because, of course, the Chinese understand that they're dependent on us so much. They've got to make way for us. So, in other words, the economic interdependence, both sides recognise that the economic interdependence constrains the capacity for rivalry, but they both think it constrains the other guy more than it constrains them. And it therefore actually discourages them from making compromises, because I think the other side will. So there is a kind of almost a counterproductive thing. Now, where does Australia fit into this? I mean,
are we capable of saying to both sides, "Oi, you know what you're saying about the
other?" I think we are capable of doing that. I think, though, your point about, you know, is it a matter of us being an intermediary? I think is a very good one. I don't think there's any role or point or necessity for Australia to act as an intermediary in what you might call a sort of classic shuttle diplomacy sense, that sort of image of, you know, China's in one room and America's in the other and they can't talk to one another, so we scurry backwards and forwards like Henry Kissinger did in the Middle East in the 1970s sort of thing. Because apart from the US and China can talk to one another. I mean, they talk to one another a lot. They don't necessarily say the right things, but they certainly communicate. And indeed, you know, this is very topical because Xi Jinping and Barack Obama are going to be meeting at the beginning of, not next week, but the week after, for what could be a really, really major event. I mean, this could be one of those occasions in which the two countries really do sit down and start talking about the foundations of their relationship. Clearly, from both what the US and the Chinese side have said, this is what they want to see happening. So I think, you know, that's sort of good news. They don't need us to be the intermediaries. But on the other hand, they do need us, or rather, perhaps we need for us, to make sure that both sides know what outcome we want. And so my argument is not that we should act as an intermediary, but that we should represent to both of them the outcome that works for us. Because I do think for both of them, they do find it difficult to see one another straight. You know, it seems like a strange thing to say, but America, for all its immense sophistication and breadth and depth of its foreign policy institutions and individuals and elites and so on, still does find it hard to see, to recognise how big China's rise is. There's still a lot of denial in the United States about the scale of China's economic power, about the extent to which that's been translated into military power, about the reality of China's ambitions to challenge American primacy, and about the lengths that China's, I think, willing to go to pursue that. I think there's a lot more realism in the US now than there was even when I wrote the book. I think the way that China has pushed back, for example, against the policy that Barack Obama announced here in Canberra was pretty significant. So, you know, I think there is a role for us to play. And the other thing is, of course, we shouldn't underestimate how our own importance. You know, Australians often, I think, do underestimate the significance, the role we can play. Barack Obama came to Canberra to give what is certainly his most important speech on China of his administration, and what is seen in the US system as the most important speech any American president has given on China for decades. How he came to Canberra to give it, that wasn't just a coincidence. It's because Australia does count. We are a pretty significant part of this picture, and we can make ourselves a more significant part if we've got real ideas to put on the table. That's what activist middle power diplomacy is all about.
Thank you. What are your thoughts on that? And more broadly, as Parliamentary Secretary for Trade, you must be aware, you know, China is reaching out through economic links to Latin America, to Africa, to... Is there a sense of competition when you go overseas, or is it... Are people apprehensive, or how do you see the relationship China has with some of the other countries we engage with?
I think that these things always are going to be competitive in one sense. So we are competing with other countries for market share, and our companies are competing with other countries. But increasingly in the globalised world, you find companies which have structures where part of their production will be in one country and part of it will be in another country. So if I go to Cotton On in North Geelong, a lot of the clothing is being made in China or Bangladesh, but the research and development and the marketing and the human resources and so on is being done in North Geelong, and they have a couple of hundred computers there staffed by young people who are getting meaningful work as a consequence of that. So I think, yes, in part it is competitive, but in part it's also cooperative, and it is possible for each country to be able to improve its living standards, rather than it being a question of if we go up, you must go down. I don't think that's been the modern experience, and as I described earlier, the rise of Asian nations has been good for them and essentially good for us as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Thoughts from both of you. We're obviously members of a number of different regional clubs. You know, there's things like the East Asia Summit.
Yep.
When Kevin Rudd was Prime Minister, there was talk of some sort of Asian Union, which didn't seem to go anywhere. We're not a member of ASEAN, and of course there were lots of contention between former Prime Minister Keating and Martin Mohammed around exactly what that would happen. There's discussions on a Asian trade partnership, or sorry, a Trans-Pacific partnership on trade. I think this is possibly in the context of the fact that there hasn't been any progress on the Doha round of trade negotiations. Without an overarching structure for everyone, do we get caught into kind of little sideways of we're in this club and not that club, and we're friends with these people but not those people, or we're having a trade deal with you but not you?
James, I don't think so. We don't seek to exclude people, and I haven't come across anyone who thinks that we do. Yes, we support Doha, but in the absence of progress there, it's reasonable to support regional and bilateral approaches. And so in relation to the TPP, China is not part of it, but that's not because it's been excluded. This process is driven by prospective new members, and to date China hasn't indicated a possible interest in joining the TPP. So the government would say that the TPP and the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership present complementary pathways to building free trade within the Asia Pacific, that they're both significant regional initiatives, and that both of them will help shape economic integration into the broader region, and that there's value in Australia being engaged in both. So it's not a question of either or, and that you can, in this respect, walk and chew gum as well.
Thank you. What do you think on the
broader question of the sort of the regional architecture, and you know, we've developed in Asia this rather strange, very complex regional architecture of all sorts of different structures and meetings and all the rest of it. Look, a lot of people sometimes complain that there's too many meetings and not enough happens in Asia. I'm not actually sure about that. I think in the end, we've succeeded, or at least the countries of Asia have succeeded, in institutions like ASEAN in doing a very good job of managing down conflict, of keeping the region peaceful. It's laid the foundations for this extraordinary economic development and regional economic interaction that Kelvin's referred to. And so, you know, I don't think we should be too down on what we've achieved so far. But I think we also need to recognise that that whole structure, ASEAN, the East Asian Summit, all of that stuff, has been based on a fundamental regional order which has had American primacy, uncontested American primacy at its core. You know, the region started working well for everyone, including for us, back in 1972 when Nixon went to Beijing and met Mao Zedong. And the deal they did there, under which America recognised the Communist government of China and China recognised American primacy as the foundation for the Asian order and stopped trying to push America out of Asia, that was what started Asia working well and provide the conditions for so much that's happened since. Now, and including the whole structure of ASEAN and all of that. Now, the challenge we face at the moment is twofold. The first is, to what extent can that structure help to manage the transition to a new order in which America no longer has sole control and has to share power with China? And the second is, once that transition has happened, can those institutions survive and adapt to work under those new circumstances? Now, I've got a mixed view on that. I don't think those institutions are going to help us manage the transition. I think the problems are too big, or rather they're so important for the few countries involved, particularly the US and China, but also Japan and India, that they're not going to negotiate their future relationship in a room with, you know, 37 different countries, you know, in a sort of, you know, grand ballroom in a hotel in Kuala Lumpur behind the little crossed flags and the bowls of mints and all that sort of stuff. That's not the way you have really difficult negotiations with very serious adversaries / partners. What you want to do is to, you know, it's a bit like negotiating your performance agreement with your boss. You don't want to do it in front of the rest of the branch at morning tea time. You actually want to do it just between the two of you. So these guys are going to have to get into a room, you know, smoke-filled room, metaphorically speaking, by themselves and talk this through. ASEAN, all of that, East Asian Summit's not going to help. But once they've done that, if they can manage that, then I think those institutions have got a big role to play in the future, as they have in the past, in managing what you might call the day-to-day, week-by-week, year-by-year stuff that comes up in the region. I think there's no reason why we shouldn't be quite optimistic about the role they can play if the fundamental order can be sustained. But to turn it the other way around, if the US and China end up having a conflict over, you know, the Senkakus or something like that, all of that stuff will be put under immense pressure, and there's nothing that those structures will be able to do to save us.
Thank you. Now I'm wondering which is more complicated, US and China negotiating or COAG?
The stakes are a bit lower in COAG, yeah, I think. I mean, it's a bad day in the office of COAG can be pretty bad, but yeah. It's not as bad as nuclear war.
Yeah, true.
Well
maybe. Depends on where one of the premiers has something they're not telling us about. I'm curious, Kevin, from your perspective, this is something I saw in an article a couple of days ago, so I apologize that you may not be properly prepared. But I remember seeing, following the collapse of the clothing factory in Bangladesh, there were concerns that there should be some sort of, you know, compact to raise wages or to set proper standards. And there were concerns raised in a couple of Australian papers that people like Target or Kmart or Sportsgirl weren't going to sign that sort of compact. Do you think there's a problem there with, although obviously living standards are increasing, that we as it were, good global corporate citizens could be like, there are people then saying, why don't I boycott all these Australian companies if they're not going to not exploit people? How do you think we balance the kind of the concerns of people as to exploitation and the actually it is raising living standards overall?
I think that proper occupational health and safety standards are a very important ingredient of the workplace and of the world that we live in. That the building collapse in Bangladesh was shameful, over 1,000 people killed, and I think that there should be a regulatory and a consumer response to that, which insists that companies which are sourcing, in this case clothing, but frankly anything from other countries, are paying proper regard to occupational health and safety standards in those workplaces. And if they are not, there is a role for governments in terms of our regulatory arrangements, and indeed there is a role for consumers to say we are not prepared to put up with this. Yes, we like to buy cheap clothing, but we are certainly not going to purchase it in circumstances which put innocent people at risk of life and limb.
Is there a role for the Australian government to talk to some of those companies, and if they're Australian companies, and see what they're doing to make sure that they're not exploiting people? Or?
Yes, I think that is certainly part of the role of government to make sure that decent standards in terms of occupational health and safety, in terms of environmental standards, in terms of exploitation of children and the like, the things which are identified and would be understood by everybody as being essential, that they are being properly observed.
Thank you. Now, moving on, I guess, in a sense, looking at trade and looking at that broader engagement, it's not just trade, it's also cultural engagement, it's diplomatic engagement. We're a middle power. Our diplomatic footprint is not as, perhaps, as big as some countries. Do you think we've got the diplomatic, as a kind of an academic outsider, do you think we've got the diplomatic heft in Asia that we need to
have? No, look, it's a good question. And, you know, I view this from the relaxed perspective of ANU these days. And mind you, I've spent a lot of my life working in government, but I've worked in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, so I can say this without appearing to do any special pleading. I do think Australia has an exceptionally good professional foreign service. You know, I think it's one of those national assets to which we don't necessarily pay enough attention. But I also do think it's too small. Some people, when they think about this issue, think that the problem is that we don't have enough posts in enough countries. And I'm not sure that's not true. I think, you know, you could make an argument as to whether we need more posts around the world. But my focus would actually be on having more people in the most important countries. And if you look, for example, at the size of our mission in Beijing, we've got a very big mission in Beijing, but the number of actual diplomats there working to understand and to influence the evolution of China's policy on the sorts of things we were talking about before, which are just unbelievably central to our future. About that many, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And most of them, of course, are ducking out to the airport to pick up the parliamentary secretary, who's probably turning up there. You know, he's a very important man. They need to do this. But you know, they've got a lot on their plate. The amount of time that our diplomats have to spend on the most important issues is not that great. And like everybody else in life, they find the really urgent's been squeezed out by the urgent, but the really important's been squeezed out by the urgent. The same thing is true, for example, in Jakarta. We have a huge mission in Jakarta, which I think actually does a very good job. But the number of people who are actually trying to get their head around what's happening in Indonesian domestic politics, which is a huge and fascinating and in some ways slightly alarming story, terribly important to Australia's future, is, you know, it's about that many. And it's a country of 240 million people, which is now deeply decentralised politically, has a very complex, fragmented political system, a field for the presidential elections next year that makes the Melbourne Cup look like a two-horse race, etc. And with the best will in the world, these guys just can't get around as much as they should. And again, they've got a lot of other things on their plate. So my argument would be, I think we have a very good foreign service. You might make a case that we need more posts, but I think the point I would really make is we need much more coverage, many more people on the ground doing the classic diplomatic job in the most important countries. And, you know, you could sort of make a list of the five or eight most important countries. I think most of us agree on them. We just don't have enough coverage there.
Thank you. On the flip side perspective of that, putting aside all the talk about Chinese hackers, do you think that particularly East Asian nations have a, as it were, important enough presence here, or they all take us for granted and they've got like two people, two posts?
Look, I think Australia is a pretty transparent society, if you know what I mean. I actually think we're an easier place to get your head around than, say, Jakarta or Beijing is. And it's not, you know, that's not to say that we're necessarily all that easy. One can still have surprises. But I think we have more trouble understanding them than they have trouble understanding us. Having said that, though, you know, some of the missions in Canberra, I think, are really outstanding. You know, some of the ones that I've had dealings with, both in my previous incarnations and at the moment. You know, these are very sophisticated people who have a surprisingly sophisticated understanding of what's going on. So I wouldn't say for a moment that we wouldn't benefit from them having a bigger presence here and understanding us better. But I've got to say, I think it's more behoven on us to make sure we're understanding their systems better rather than vice versa.
I wouldn't mind responding, James. I agree with Hugh's point about Australian diplomats being extremely good and professional and well regarded. And I had the opportunity in 2011 to be one of two MPs who went to the United Nations General Assembly and watched Australia's UN mission in action. And they were extremely impressive. And in fact, while I was there, really their key performance indicator was to get Australia elected to the UN Security Council with one of the temporary seats. And of course, we romped home in relation to that, which is a tribute to their work and also, I think, a reflection of the regard in which Australia is held generally and the credibility. The, you know, our campaign slogan was, "We mean what we say," and I think that was accepted by most countries around the world. But I do need to defend our presence abroad, and particularly, as you don't want me agreeing with you all the time, observe that we are continuing to develop that presence internationally, and for Austrade, in relation to which I have a particular responsibility, we've got 86 locations in 50 markets, 44 offices in the 15 markets of Asia. We've recently established a new consulate in Bogota in Colombia and additional trade commissioner positions in Accra, Ghana and Sao Paulo, Brazil. We've got new offices in Mongolia and in Shenyang in China. In Chengdu in southwest China, DFAT's establishing a new consulate general. And we've also got the new trade commissioner to Myanmar, Mark Wood, commencing duties there. So we have got a program of increasing our presence, and I think we are doing very well with the diplomatic presence that we have and are taken pretty seriously around the place.
Thank you. If all those wonderfully skilled Australian people land what they're working on, which I'm sure they will, what kind of benefit to Australia's kind of trade economy are we looking at? Are we looking at don't wait for anything, it's not going to be for 15 years, or are we going to see tangible benefits in, or relatively soon?
I think we are seeing tangible benefits, and the kind of increase in our trade that I referred to earlier reflects that. Obviously, mining has been very important for Australia's prosperity and continues to be so. And last week I was in Chile, which is in many respects quite a similar country geographically, and for them mining is important as well, and the links that we have to a place like that are very useful. But it is very apparent that Australia cannot afford to be a one-trick pony and has to look beyond the mining boom and have other areas of prosperity and economic activity. And being high-tech, having good quality innovative products is extremely important, and as I've been visiting industries and enterprises around Australia, I've been very impressed by how much people are able to do that. And the other thing that I think is really important for us and that Austrade is working on is food processing and manufacturing. Australia is one of the relatively few countries in the world which is able to both meet its own food requirements and export food in significant quantities. The fact is that food is unlikely to go out of fashion in a world of increasing population and increasing affluence. The demand is going to be there from other countries, and I think this is an area of great potential for Australia and one of those areas where Austrade is playing a key role.
Thank you. It's interesting you mentioned mining because, of course, I think this week China announced it's looking at implementing its emission trading scheme. India's placed a price on carbon, essentially, and China's not just going to have an emission trading scheme, it's kind of a decreasing cap on its use of coal. And that leads me to think, well, firstly, are we prepared? We seem to be prepared because we've got a carbon price, but there is an election coming up. And, of course, the opposition had very different policies around, essentially mining and resource use and carbon use. And I was thinking from both of you, what are the perspectives? What signals has the opposition given around its engagement with Asia and do they just seemingly expect that we'll keep mining WA until there's nothing left? Because apart from some recent statements from the Shadow Foreign Minister on academic freedom in relation to Israel and how we're going to have a Colombo plan, I can't really think of anything that seems to be engaging with some of the real announcements from China and India that have come out in the last year. So I just think, do you think the opposition is engaged with the reality of what Asia's telling us?
Look, I don't think there's any... I don't see any evidence that the opposition has any particular agendas as to how it wants to manage and develop our relationship with Asia that the present government hasn't pursued, if you know what I mean. I think, you know, there's some sort of rhetorical differences, but there is the very specific peculiarity, if I can put it this way, of what seems to me to be Tony Abbott's approach to Indonesia, which is to tell them to take the boats back and then build a fundamentally new relationship on that basis. I think relationships with Indonesia are a bit harder than that, but other than that, the conclusion I draw from that is that they haven't really put a lot of thought into this issue. That this is not something that they've really, addressed very much. Whether or not in government they'd end up taking a very different view, I don't know. I don't think so. Certainly on the issue that I've been most engaged in myself, this question about how we respond to the rise of China and what that means for the US-China relationship and all that sort of thing. I think they've been very quiescent.
On the climate change aspect of this, I think it is quite troubling because, as you said, other countries are doing a lot in relation to climate change and seeking to move towards renewable energy, and even countries like the US and China, which haven't been helpful in terms of the Kyoto Protocol and the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, are nevertheless doing very significant things in terms of moving to renewable energy. This can be quite useful for Australia. I mean, it's useful for the planet, it's essential for the planet, but it can also be useful for Australia because we have reasonably well-developed renewable energy technologies and some natural advantages in this area. But the key signposts that we've put turn our energy mix into a renewable energy mix. The carbon price, the renewable energy target of 20% by 2020, the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, the Renewable Energy Agency, all of these things are threatened by a change of government. And if those things were to happen, then the way in which Australia is now progressively moving down a renewable energy path would come to an abrupt halt, and with that, the capacity of Australian businesses to take advantage of the kind of moves you're talking about in China, in India, in the US, in Europe and beyond.
Thank you. Now, in terms of your role as Parliamentary Secretary of Trade, you're kind of, as it were, agnostic towards Australian trade. Like, if we get trade, you don't care if the company's necessarily opening a, at least I hope you don't, whether it's going to open a, in Wills or in... I don't know.
No, I think it's particularly important that it
<in Wills. laughs> yeah.
But at the same time, you know, you're representing all of Australia. But even as a kid, I remember, premiers of Victoria going over and doing trade fairs, and you've got Lord Mayors and people. Is it considering? Can you make sure we're all rowing in the same boat?
That is.
Because they've all got vested interests to say, I'd like the new factory here.
Yes.
Whereas that may not be in the national interest. So how can you,
It's an excellent question, James, and you're quite right in terms of how this occurs. And I've noticed it myself in my visits abroad that states will have their own representation and presence and may well be seeking to brand themselves as opposed to branding Australia, but we. We do our best, given the restrictions and constraints of the federal system, to have a Team Australia approach to engagement with overseas markets. There is regular contact between the federal and state and territory ministers, and we have quite a lot of discussions about state ministers and local officials about what they're doing. There are some formal trade consultative mechanisms, and so there is quite a lot done to try and have an Australian presence. If you're talking about conventions and exhibitions and the like, where you can go there and see the various states, and even if in some respects their interests are competitive, it's still good to cluster them together to promote Australia, and I think they've got some understanding of this in the same way that florists or new car dealers or whatever often don't mind being parked in the same strip because consumers get an understanding that that's the place to go if you want to get flowers or a new car.
Thank you. Last two questions from me before we open up the floor. Obviously, a lot of the issues around trade and engagement requires a cultural understanding. Mm. You know, we need to encourage kids to learn languages. We need to have the teaching capacity to teach the languages. We need perhaps a shift in our thinking on the street, because there was that unfortunate unpleasantness a couple of years ago with Indian students in Victoria that got a lot of press. There was stuff on Chinese students in Sydney being attacked on trains. And certainly as an ex-high school teacher and as someone who's worked in education policy, I know under both Howard and Rudd and Gillard governments, we always talk about getting teachers to teach languages and getting kids to study languages, but we still seem to not be able to get kids to study languages.
Yes.
What do you think, why do we keep coming back to the situation? How do we change the culture or the uptake so that people actually want to do this stuff? Like when I was teaching high school kids, they were like, well, they all speak English, don't they? But, how do we change that attitude?
Sure. Well, James, I do my best on a micro level. Any young people in my orbit, I suggest if you want to get on in life, and particularly if you want to be part of foreign affairs, you should be learning a language. The Asian Century White Paper says that every Australian student should have significant exposure to studies of Asia across the curriculum to increase their cultural knowledge and skills and enable them to be active in the region. So all schools will engage with at least one school in Asia to support the teaching of a priority Asian language and make use of the national broadband network in doing that. And the white paper also talks about an Asia Literacy Business Ambassadors Initiative with some 300 ambassadors who will boost student demand by increasing understanding of the benefits of studies of Asia. The other point I mention on this front is that Austrade is a highly Asia-capable organisation. About 60% of Austrade's 558 international staff positions are based in Asia, and more than 400 Austrade employees speak one or more Asian languages. So it's a pretty Asia-capable organisation as it stands, and we are seeking to improve and build on that.
Hugh, obviously, as a scholar, over the years you would have seen numerous governments say we're going to have every school teaching languages.
Yeah, I start from a humiliating position on this issue, and that is I speak no languages other than the one you're hearing me speak now. And not actually, if you want to try, I studied Bahasa as a schoolboy a long time ago, but it didn't stick. However, I mean, I think the basic proposition is absolutely unanswerable. I think we need, for all of these reasons, all of the strategic questions, all of the economic reasons, and in a sense all the social and cultural reasons we've talked about, expanding our capacity to function effectively in Asia means learning a whole lot of languages. This is just something as a country we're not very good at. You know, some countries are no good at sport, we're no good at languages. But I do think I have a slightly radical solution to this, and not one necessarily that my friends in the chalky profession always necessarily like. Because what we keep on trying to do is to teach young Australians Asian languages in Australia. There's another model. You go to Asia to learn the Asian languages. And I've argued that the most cost-effective way of building up our Asian literacy fast is to send large numbers, thousands of young Australians to live in Asia for a year or two to learn languages. And this is, I think, an idea which is, you know, whose time might have come. It seems horrendous, but you know, you could send a young a person as part of their university degree, for example, or at the end of their high school, to Indonesia for a year for something like $10,000 or $12,000. You could send 10,000, and it's only going to cost you $100 million a year. And actually, in the grand sweep, what we're talking about, that's not very much. And one of the advantages is you don't just get to learn the language; you get to learn a lot about the country. And I mean, I think actually, it's fascinating in relation to China, but I think in some ways it's even more pressing in relation to Indonesia. Because at least in relation to China, we have in Australia a big Chinese-Australian community. We actually, as a country, I think, are getting to know China pretty well one way or another. But Indonesia, as Kelvin said, it's going to be a very big economy. It is and will remain a very big country demographically. It's going to be a really big player in Asia. It's going to be much more important to us than it's been in the past, and we still know so little about it. And I think, you know, sending 10,000 young Australians to spend a year in Indonesia learning Bahasa, and that would be, I think, a way of, you know, apart from the else, it could be quite good fun, and you might hope it's not too much fun. Depends on which part of Indonesia they go to, I guess. But I think that kind of innovative approach to solving this problem. Yeah, well, it might work though.
Well, would it have to be compulsory? Because it seems as though if you give kids the choice in your average Australian school to do a language, they don't do it anymore.
Well, but I think if you say, would you like to go and live in Indonesia for a year,
and
we're going to pay
your
for you?
All expenses paid. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I reckon.
The offset.
I reckon you could make that sing.
Okay.
Last
question from me. We've been engaged with Asia now for 40 years, as both of you observed. You know, there was Nixon went to China.
Yes.
Whitlam went to China.
Yeah.
As Prime Minister Keating talked a lot about our place in Asia, and we've had, obviously, a re-engagement of that with both Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard. Do you think we're getting any better at matching our talk? Because it seems we keep talking about being in Asia, and every few years we keep talking again about being in Asia.
Yes. Yes.
So do you think we're nearly there? Do you think we've landed it, or do you think we've still got some way to go?
Yeah.
About actually making the reality match the rhetoric.
Yes. Well, I think the
what's different now?
I think the problem is it's a moving target. I mean, you're right. We've, you know, the Asian story is not a new story, and you're absolutely right. It took a fundamentally new trajectory when Whitlam beat Kissinger to China in 1972. It took a really, you know, we've had, I think, a terrific national achievement to build the relationships we've got. And I don't think we want to be sort of, you know, falsely modest about this. I think it's something we've done very well. And we got some things right. I mean, you know, we did actually eventually get our heads in the right place and get rid of the White Australia policy just in time. I mean, boy, we're lucky we got that right. So we have got some things right. But the trouble is, every time we turn around, we discover an Asia which is bigger and more dynamic and more important and more complex and more demanding than the last time we looked. So, you know, when Nixon went to China, when Whitlam went to China, China had an economy that was about 1/20th the size of America's and smaller than Australia's. In the mid-1980s, China's economy was smaller than Australia's. And people like Bob Hawke and Ross Garnaut and Paul Keating in a very visionary way said, hey, this is a really interesting and important country. We've got to get our head around it and really get close to it. And they were right. But the China we've got to work with today is completely different from the China that they were starting to get their heads around. Likewise, you know, people have been, ever since Indonesia emerged in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, people have realised this was a pretty important country. But we get used to thinking of Indonesia as a country which is big and interesting but poor and weak. Well, it's still big and interesting, but it's not poor and weak anymore. Its economy is bigger than ours. Its economy has got a very good chance of being twice the size of ours within a couple of decades. And so we make some progress, but then the target keeps moving. We have to work harder and harder to build more and more depth into these relationships, because they become more and more important to us, because these countries become richer and more powerful.
Kelvin, in your time in politics, you would have seen the focus on Asia ebb and flow. Do you think we're getting better at it? Do you think we've nearly nailed it?
No question that the relationship is infinitely stronger and more sophisticated than it used to be. So the trade relationships are much greater, the investment relationships are much greater, composition of our people, the number of people who we have of Chinese and Indian and other backgrounds has greatly increased, the number of international students has greatly increased. So the extent and the breadth and depth of the interactions has changed out of all sight, as Hugh has suggested. I think there is plenty of scope for the relationship to continue to grow, and that's exactly what the Australia in the Asian Century White Paper is all about. I think what's important in all this is that we take advantage of the opportunity by making sure that we have the skills and the education and the technological base and so on ourselves to do this, rather than engaging in the sort of simplistic thinking that goes, well, because the Asian countries are going to grow in demand, that we're sitting pretty in terms of supplying our abundant natural resources to them, and that's it, and we can, you know, sit back and wait for the money to flow in. I think that is a dangerously short-sighted and imprudent approach. I think that for us, it brings with it opportunities, but it also brings with it challenges. So, you know, if you're a clothing factory in my electorate, the competition from Korea and the like is ferocious. So there, it brings not only opportunities, but it also brings challenges. And it's essential that we are high skilled and high tech and constantly innovative and working on the relationship rather than feeling relaxed and comfortable about it.
Mm. Thank you very much. Thank you both. Have we got any questions from the floor? Please put your hand up. Yes, thank you.
just back to one of Hugh's early points, you're obviously concerned about the risk of a dangerous clash between the US and China. What can we actually do about this? I mean, that is a real worry.
Yes, yes.
People keep saying, well, you know, they're both each other's largest trading partner,
yes,
essentially.
Yeah.
But then the same was true of the UK and Germany before.
That's right, 1914, that's right. Yep. Yep.
And what can we do in practice?
Well, look, I think, you know, it's a terribly good and important question, and the answer, I'm afraid, is a bit discouraging. That is, I don't think there's much you can do other than to try and do what you can, for us to do what we can as a country, to address the underlying source of the rivalry between them, which drives the risk of conflict. See, the United States and China could easily go to war over the Senkakus, but it won't be about the Senkakus any more than the First World War was about the poor old Archduke. It's about their different views of their roles in Asia and their relationship with one another. And reconciling those different views is, you know, really essential for them to have a stable relationship and essential to drive down the risk of conflict that you've talked about. And I don't think it's impossible that Australia can have an influence on that. I think we've got a pretty good record diplomatically of being able to help shape the region. That's what activist diplomacy, middle power diplomacy is all about. But it's going to require us to be willing to say pretty tough things to both countries. And I think that's going to require us to take a kind of an approach to our regional diplomacy, which is much more, you know, out there and in their faces than we have been so far. And I also think it requires us to work with other countries in the region. Mm. You know, one of the bits of good news, if you like, is that it seems to me that Australia's interest in a stable future in Asia are the same as everybody else's. Mm. And so we don't have to go into Washington and Beijing and deliver this message by ourselves. But before we can get to that, we do have to acknowledge to ourselves that we have a problem. And I think the main problem we have is that we don't yet as a country acknowledge to ourselves that all of the benefits that we've derived from having a close relationship with the United States and a close relationship with China are threatened by the trajectory of their relationship. And because we don't yet acknowledge that problem, we're not yet focused on doing anything about it.
Any other questions? Yes?
It seems the only time we hear about China in the media is when a politician is saying we don't like foreign investment from China here in Australia, or when the Dalai Lama is here and a university wants to host him or politicians want to engage with him. To what extent do politicians have a responsibility to lead a conversation about incorporating and familiarising ordinary Australians who tend not to go along to these sorts of events or get terribly interested in excellently written books, I imagine, in order to facilitate that sort of engagement with China in the upcoming century?
Well, look, I mean, I think, Kelvin have a few answers, of course, but I actually think government has done pretty well, and I should say successive governments have done pretty well in explaining to Australians just how important Asia is to us. It seems like a silly example, but I remember in one of those budgets in the early in the last decade, Costello just about stood up and said, here's a whole lot of tax cuts, and they've been brought to you by China. So it's not as though governments have been reluctant, as I say, on both sides of politics have been reluctant to explain the China story. I think though that the problem we face is that it's too easy to present it just as a simple, you know, sort of Kelvin touched on it before. There's China; they're buying more and more of our stuff for higher and higher prices. All we have to do is sort of sit back and, you know, ride the sleigh. It is going to be more complicated than that. Now, I think the government deserves credit in the Asian Century White Paper for identifying both how important all this is going to be to us and identifying that this is going to require us to change a lot of what we do. It's not just a matter of us taking advantage of what they're doing. We're going to have to adapt to it. I think that's a very important message. But I would say that both sides of politics, and indeed the broader public debate in Australia, has still not really accommodated how different it's going to be for Australia to live in an Asia in which, to take the most obvious example, our great and powerful friends are no longer the dominant power. I mean, this is new for us. Since 1788, Australia has always had the luxury of being a very close ally of an Anglo-Saxon power which has dominated Asia strategically. And this is not going to be true within a couple of decades. In fact, in a sense, it's not true now. So I don't think we've yet explained governments, the public debate more broadly, it's not just governments, also academics and journalists and all the rest of us are in this whole business, have not yet really started the conversation to say just how different the Asian century is going to be. It's going to be more different than we think.
Okay. I might add that I think, notwithstanding the premise of your question, that there is quite a lot of both political engagement and political sympathy towards China, and recently, of course, as has been mentioned, the Prime Minister visited China with the Minister for Foreign Affairs and the Minister for Trade and other senior ministers, and concluded the deal concerning the converting of the Chinese yuan, and also the arrangement for regular high-level bilateral meetings. And it seemed clear to me that that visit was regarded in a very positive way and wasn't controversial in the slightest. Indeed, if there's any Liberal Party criticism, it tends to be that we should do more, we should be engaged more, which is ironic in one sense, because I'm old enough to remember Gough Whitlam going to China and being the idea was that he was a communist fellow traveller and unfit for public office and all that sort of thing. Yeah. Whereas now the Liberal Party seems to me to be highly sympathetic towards China, and not too many of them would be seen dead in the Dalai Lama. So,
one thing you said there, you focus, your answer mostly about the economics of it. We sent sort of trade and foreign affairs in this sense. With the idea of politicians leading the conversation, do we also have to worry about, say, morality and culture and these things when we're looking at China and saying we want to criticise you for these sorts of things, and you want to criticise us for engaging with the Dalai Lama? Is sending sort of trade officials the right people to facilitate that conversation, or do you have to get that conversation away first and then you can deal with morality and politics?
The trade officials tend not to be engaged in such discussions. Trade officials are engaged in trade talks. So, of course, where we have issues that we want to talk with China about that have the foreign policy characteristics about them, it'll be Department of Foreign Affairs officials who do that, and they do. We raise issues of concern, human rights issues, and indeed sometimes we've had business people involved in disputes in China, which have been difficult disputes, and so we get involved there in terms of protecting our interests.
Yep.
It seems to me that there's a pretty massive elephant in the room, and perhaps I arrived after the discussion, but I don't get the impression that I did. On the 17th of January 1961, when I happened to be a zygote about it, normally a dick, 3 weeks in utero, a bloke called Ike Eisenhower made a speech just before handing over to JFK, and he was very, very solemn, talking about how before World War II, when there was a war, manufacturers of farming equipment would retool and manufacture what we needed for war. But since World War II, for the first time in human history, there was a permanent and vast armaments industry, as well as being having a vast, vast numbers of men and women in uniform. And the two elements being what he called, and the world first heard this term that day, the military-industrial complex. And he got very, very solemn, 3-minute YouTube interview if you want to have a look at it, or speech, by the way, not interview. And he got very, very solemn, warning about the grave danger, his words, grave danger, this was a bloke who was 5-star general in World War II, before being 8 years president, of the grave danger of getting into wars that we neither want nor need. And he warned that we need to be vigilant. And what he was effectively saying was every business needs a customer, and that, in my term, is that, the monster needs to feed. So 12 months later, JFK is in office, and he's having a meeting with his top military brass, and he leaves the meeting, disgusted, plans it all, says to his aides, those guys are fucking crazy. They were trying to get him to agree to a mock invasion of Cuba, and so this would enrage the American people and cause them to support a full-scale invasion of Cuba. And then, of course, 22nd of November the next year, in Dallas, we know what happened to JFK. And since that day, the people of Cuba and Central America have believed that JFK died for them. Very large numbers of them have believed that. Okay. So, fast forward to a whole bunch, and we've got, there's any number of books now talking about the United States of America, our closest ally, being the greatest terrorist nation this planet's ever seen. Right? And of course you've got them, it's a joke, Four Corners exposed it, but it's a complete joke to suggest that the United States doesn't want Julian Assange. Malcolm Fraser wrote an article about 2 months ago suggesting that we distance ourselves from the United States. Pretty good advice, I'd suggest. There's a hell of a lot of good middle countries in the world, which we're one of them. How long is this government going to ignore the elephant in the room and maintain a relationship with a country which since 1942 has been our adopted parent and has frankly gone completely insane?
Well, I don't accept the premise of your question. I and other members of the government support the United States alliance and believe that there are good reasons for us to be supportive of that. Doesn't mean that we have to agree with every decision that the US takes, and we haven't. There have been some conspicuous and notable differences in foreign policy approaches over the years, but in terms of the fundamental benefit of that alliance to Australia, I believe that continues to be the case. I'm aware of what Eisenhower said. That was said 50 years ago, and we haven't.
Suggesting it's less true today.
I'm suggesting we have at least been able to contain these things and haven't degenerated into wholesale war. Of course, there have been conflicts over the years, and those things are unfortunate. But I think that vigilance is important. But I don't believe it's the case that, for example, America and China are likely to engage in conflict. I think that the extent of the economic integration of those countries is so great that the business communities on both sides would be horrified at the prospect of conflict between them, and therefore my own view is that that is unlikely. Now, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be concerned about these things and make our concerns known to both sides, but I think that it is unlikely.
Yep.
I feel quite privileged growing up in a nation where I never felt I needed to leave our borders, I guess, to experience Europe or Asia. Primary school years were in little Europe, surrounded by Italians, and later in life found myself next to Chinatowns.
Mm.
So I guess I'm wondering, in contrast to that idea of sending what I imagine of white Australians to Indonesia to learn language, what role both of you see for the culturally, linguistically and ethnically diverse Australians we have here?
I don't presuppose that it's just Caucasian Australians who ought to be going to Asia to learn languages. One does, and the evidence is reasonably strong, at least for the first couple of generations, people who come to Australia from Asia keep their languages up, but we can't take that for granted. I think this is something we need to take a very long-term view of. I think it's very important that we think of, you know, preserving and building a long-term approach to making sure that Australia, as a country, which I'm assuming, is going to continue to be pretty monolingual in its domestic linguistic profile, teaches as many of its people as possible other languages, and of course not just Asian languages, but I think Asian languages are going to be the most important ones. I don't think that's incompatible with a lot of cultural diversity, and it certainly doesn't suggest, I certainly wouldn't suggest that it means we should turn our back on Europe, either culturally or linguistically, or in values terms. But I do think at the moment the balance is way too far the other way. You know, we have a much better take-up of European languages than we do of Asian languages, and that to me just doesn't make sense. I don't think it's good for us.
But can I make a point about the role of the diaspora, if you like, that in Australia we have outfits like Australia Turkish Business Council or Australia Malaysia Chamber of Commerce and so on, most of the members of which have, you know, Turkish heritage or Malaysian heritage or whatever, and their contacts and networks within their home countries are very important in establishing business links, and you'll find that there is a great deal of trade and commerce comes as a result of that.
Another question? No. Oh. David?
Yeah. It's actually two for Hugh. one is, do you see any evidence of willingness in the American administration to accommodate China?
Yes.
And the second is, what role do you see for values in informing Australia's relationship with Australia, with the US or China?
Yes. Well, two very good questions. The second one's a very big question indeed. Look, the question as to how the United States is starting to think about this is a very interesting one, and I think it's right on the cusp at the moment. I think when for a long time, until about 2009, the United States kind of was not paying attention to what was happening with China. Of course, they knew that its economy was growing. They were very preoccupied, for understandable reasons, with the Middle East. And the stark reality of China's growth, the scale of its growing power, the scale of its ambitions, I think, was not clear. I think since then, and even since the Obama speech here in Parliament in November 2011, the US has started to understand where China's coming from much more clearly. And I think the tendency to assume that the China would in the end accept American primacy as the foundation for the Asian order indefinitely into the future, which I think was there and was reflected in the Obama speech in 2011, I think that has now been, that's now, you know, under pressure. I think there's a now much more open discussion in the US about these issues. And I mean, you know, it doesn't want to be anecdotal about these things, but I talk to Americans a lot about this. I've been talking to them a lot about it for a long time. And the last time I was in Washington for a couple of weeks in December last year, I found, and I was sort of, you know, trying to flog this book, literally and metaphorically, and I found much, no American says, great idea, here, let's do that. But the willingness to draw the argument out and engage with it was very much there. And it is one of the strengths, of course, of the American system. I mean, they can sort of drive you mad in all sorts of ways. But one of the things about Washington is that it does remain a very open market for ideas. And if you've got an idea there, they'll listen to you. And the characteristic experience I've had of trying to flog these ideas in Washington is old friends and new friends, for that matter, saying, I've read your book, completely disagree with you. Let's go to lunch and talk about it. Which is, I find very engaging, if I can put it that way. The question of values, this is huge. Because, well, you know, my argument is we should treat China as an equal. And a lot of people say, how can we treat as an equal a country whose values are so different from ours? And I think there are at least, and I don't have an answer to that in a sense, but I just make two observations. The first is that if we choose not to treat China as an equal, we will be choosing to treat China as an adversary. And that would be very costly for us. It would also be very costly for the Chinese. And when I say we, I don't just mean we Australia, I mean we the West. And, you know, this seems like an excessively stark way to put it, but I think we will either treat China as an equal or we will take it on as a rival. And as a very significant rival, because you've got to remember the thing about China is, in the end, wealth is power, and China is more wealthy relative to the United States than any country has ever been since the United States became a world power. And China is more wealthy and more important to Australia than any country has ever been to us, except for our great and powerful friends. So this is a new experience for all of us. And to take that country on as a rival because we don't like its values would be a very big thing to do. Now, that's not to say there are not things about China's values that one doesn't like, but one's got to look at the other side of the ledger. The other point, of course, is we do have to be fair in our judgment of China. A lot of terrible things happen in China. I absolutely understand that. But I do think you can't look at China today without recognising that hundreds of millions of people lead profoundly better lives than their parents did. And I mean better lives in really important ways, ways that we in our political culture recognise it as important. Better education, better housing, better healthcare, more opportunities for travel. These things matter. And the Chinese Communist Party, I mean, this is a provocative way to put it, but people who are wearing the Make Poverty History bracelets a few years ago, the Chinese Communist Party has done more to make poverty history than anybody else in the world, and make poverty history in morally significant ways. So we just have to at least give them credit for that, whilst we also recognise that all sorts of really ghastly things happen there. And how we balance those, I don't know.
Thank you.
Can I just point out that China doesn't have a monopoly on really ghastly things, and if we ought to take a really close look at ourselves, because in this country, I can tell you something that happens right now. If you start a third political movement in competition to the If you change the I Liberal to an A, what you've got is the Labour Party. First word is being red to Labour, and the next four being blue for Liberal. Yeah. So that's what we have in government. We have that for a long, long time. And regardless of who wins this next election, whether it's Julie or Tony, we'll still have the Labour. So if you have an opposition to the Labour Party, right, and threatening to take the middle ground, what happens to them is this. In 12 weeks, after never being attacked physically in 51 years, they get attacked, believing it's attacked three times in their train stations. In 51 years, after never having after knowing the difference between romantic interest and other interest, there are three bait girls approach the leader who clearly are after romantic interest and then switch to fishing and romantic interest dries up. The Facebook and Google profiles, with all the information, get compromised and the Google search engines and are not found. They get hidden. You can't promote truthful information because it's, while it's widely available on the net, if you put it together in one lump, into a concentration of truth, it gets struck off the Google search engines.
Did this happen to Christine Milne?
This is happening for me, and for the last 12 weeks it's been happening for me.
There is a third party, there's the Greens, so you can't say it's just Labour. Maybe this is a discussion.
No, I'm not talking about the Greens, sorry.
I wasn't talking about my party. Well, as a Fabian, I disagree that there's a difference between Labour and Liberal. But that's a question for another day. Look, I'd like to thank our distinguished guest speaker, Spruker Book people. I'd also like to thank the audience for showing up. It's lovely. I'd like to thank Smiths. I'd like to remind everyone that you should all join the Fabians, because it's only due to support of members, hopefully yourselves, we can keep doing these sorts of events. And we also have a Twitter feed, which is ACT Fabians, and we've got a Facebook page to advertise events. We try and put on 3 or 4 events every year, and we consider ourselves as a progressive left of centre think tank, although I'm sure some people will disagree with that description. Have a lovely night and a better weekend. Thank you.